You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating stuff going on today in the, what do you call it, monkey court? In front of Daryl Issa today? In the No, this isn't Daryl Issa's committee. This is, or is it? I think it's, no, I don't believe it is. In any case, in the U.S. House of Representatives, very, very interesting stuff going on. We will get to that in just a moment. I want to follow up on a conversation that we had yesterday about capital gains tax and get into that a little bit. What's going on in the United States today with, you know, kind of our day in racism, I guess would be a way to say it. An interesting experience I had yesterday, and that is, and what's going on with Barney's in New York. And I want to share that with you. But first, Jerry Byrne is on the line with us, and Jerry is the a member of the, is that Modoc County? How do you say that, Jerry?
It's Modoc.
Okay, the Modoc County Board of Supervisors in the state of California. The website is co.modoc.ca.us. And Jerry, tell us what you guys are up to.
Well, we recently voted a petition to withdraw from the state of California following Siskiyou County doing that first. And this is basically what the county is, the county government, that's our only role in this, is to vote this petition in, and then it'll be up to the people to make it happen if they so choose.
So, are you Canadian by any chance?
No.
Oh, okay. Californian. Yeah, the way you said about, I thought. In any case, I have long suggested that it's crazy that, Vermont and Oklahoma have two senators each and they have, roughly 500,000 people. And California has, 27 million people, something like that, some mind-boggling number of people.
Yeah.
And they have two senators. Yeah.
Yes.
And in fact, I think that, frankly, America would be have a much better representation in Congress if California was split into three states at least, and possibly four. Texas was split into two. Florida was split into two. New York State, New York City separated. Just that simple thing would produce a Senate that was more representative of the United States. It probably wouldn't change the House of Representatives all that much. And it would give more local control to people in those individual states. What's the motivation in your county for wanting to create this new state that you want to call Jefferson?
Okay. Well, this is, it's really not a liberal, conservative thing. It's not a Republican Democrat thing. It's about self-representation of a people who have none currently. You know, our voices are not heard whatsoever in the state of California, and the people on the Oregon side of the border have the same problem with Salem. So, It's like you said, it's a very large state, and we have, for instance, Los Angeles has 25 plus representatives, while the northern third of California only has four. So it's about a lack of representation.
And a pretty straightforward thing. I guess I've said my piece on this. In order to create a state, in order for a county or a series of counties, a region to separate itself from a state requires, is it a majority or a supermajority in California of the state assembly and the state senate to agree with you?
It's just a majority, and okay. It doesn't have to be signed by the governor. A majority of the state legislature and then a majority of the House and the Senate at the federal level.
Are you getting any feedback from anybody? What do you think the chances of this are?
Well, I mean, this is a huge uphill battle, of course, because, like you say, California now has two U.S. senators, and do the people at the other states really want to give us more, because they probably think, they hear too much from California anyhow, but it's something that's been done, like you said, from other states have done this in the past, and it's a legal way to do it through the Constitution. And
what's the history of states that have done this? I'm unfamiliar with that.
Let's see. Maine was separated from Massachusetts in 1820, Vermont from New York in 1791, West Virginia from Virginia in 1863, and Kentucky from Virginia in 1792. So nothing very recent.
Yeah, nothing recent, but certainly the timeline there indicates clearly that doing this would comport well with the intention of the founders. I would think, given that these very Northern California counties are very rural and tend to be politically more conservative/Republican than Democrat/liberal, that the folks in Washington, D.C. would not be so opposed to this. I mean, it seems like, you know, the Republicans pretty much are controlling the legislative agenda these days, or at least in the House of Representatives. Have you gotten a good hearing from the Republican Party on this?
No, I mean, we've spoken with our own Congressman Glamalfa, and he, likes the idea of it, of course. But
sure, because I think the state
is the tougher battle, because the state.
Yeah, I'm guessing in the Senate they're not going to be all that happy about having suddenly two Republican senators, two new Republican senators in the U.S.
And
Senate.
That's probably not a given, because I think the population of the 14 counties or however many counties they're talking about is like roughly 200,000 registered Republicans and 150,000 registered Democrats,
so could,
plus independents. So
right.
It's not, a huge difference, really.
Yeah. So it's more representative of a purple state, of a swing district, as it were.
Yeah. And I think the issues are more urban versus rural than they are, like I said, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, because it's people don't understand. I don't go down to Los Angeles and tell them how to solve their crime problems, and they probably shouldn't be enacting legislation how to, grow potatoes, raise cattle, that sort of thing, because they don't have any understanding of that either. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense. Well, Jerry, will you keep us up to date on how it's going?
Okay. We will. Yeah.
Okay. And where can people learn more about it?
Looking at it right now. Pardon?
Where can people learn more about it?
There's JeffersonDeclaration.net is the website that Mark Baird, who is one of the founders of this movement, has.
Mm-hmm.
And you can follow along there with what all the different counties and stuff are doing.
Are there any, in my idea of California splitting up, it would be, San Diego South, Los Angeles South, and San Francisco South, and then you guys in the North, and that would make four states, and you would have basically three urban hubs, San Diego, L.A., and San Francisco. San Diego is fairly conservative, although the surrounding areas may not be. I'm not sure. So I think that would be another purple district. The L.A. Part, if that became its own state, would, L.A. and East would almost certainly be Democratic. The San Francisco and East would almost certainly be Democratic. And what is now California would end up with eight senators, and probably the same number of members of the House of Representatives. That seems like that would be actually possibly an easier lift for the Democrats and Republicans in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House to handle, given that it would have arguably a net, balancing effect. Have you talked to anybody in any of the other counties to the south about, hey, you guys should do the same thing?
Yeah, well, we're sort of focusing on, our area up here. I know there has been a movement down in the south to start something. I don't think it's actually gone anywhere yet.
Because there's more people living in Los Angeles than in probably the six or eight smallest states population-wise combined.
Right, right.
So it just seems like a logical thing. Okay, Jerry, thank you very much. One last question, if you don't mind. Are you in communication? I used to live in Vermont. Louise and I used to live in Vermont, and there's a small secessionist movement there, which is more of a liberal secessionist movement. They're actually talking about seceding from the United States, oddly enough. But have you had any communication with people in other states who are thinking about doing this kind of thing?
I personally have not. No, I know CBS Sunday Morning is doing a show, and it's going to encompass all these movements.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're talking to all of them.
Well, that should be fascinating.
And we're just focusing on this.
Yeah. Well, Jerry Byrne, I wish you well. I'm a big fan, even as a progressive, a big fan of local control. So we'll see how this shakes out. Jerry Byrne, the chair of the Modoc County, California Board of Supervisors. Thanks for being with us.
Okay, thank you so much.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. And, and racism. I want to talk about this. And we'll be right. Oh, we are back. 15 minutes past the hour. Oh, my, what a day. Nate Sweet is on the line with us, producer of The Big Picture. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Great. Let me pull out my TV show notes here. We're going to start out with the other 99% speaks out about J.P. Morgan. Tell us about
that. Yeah, Alexis Goldstein is coming on. A lot of people might remember her from the Occupy movement. She's one of the outspoken voices against big banks and the bailouts, et cetera. She's always, you know, passionate activist, so she'll be here coming onto the show talking about both the Bank of America case is found liable for fraud in relation to some mortgage-backed securities sales, and also about the J.P. Morgan settlement. Sort of, there seems to be some sort of push for making the banksters pay these days, but when you dig deep down into the details of the cases, that's not really as good as it looks. So she'll help us break that all down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then Mike Farrell, the actor and anti-death penalty advocate, is going to drop by both to talk about the death penalty and mm-hmm. the Keeling Curve, this new play that he's performing in.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of your viewers will probably remember him from MASH, and he's going to be talking about, the death penalty case. The Supreme Court is hearing a case on a Florida man who barely meets the state's requirements for
Mental competence.
Yeah, mental competence. He has like one IQ point more, and he's challenging his death sentence. He thinks that, you know, the IQ tests have too much of a margin of error.
Or at least his lawyers think that.
Right.
In fact, his lawyers are arguing that he doesn't have a high enough IQ to understand that.
Yeah. Well, that would make sense.
Yeah.
And then David Keeling is one of the forefathers of climate science. He worked at the Mauna Loa Observation Center out in Hawaii, and Mike Farrell is starring as him in a new play. And he'll be talking to us both about that play and what some of the solutions he sees to solve climate change and tackle
right.
it before it gets too out of control.
And I know we had a conversation about this on the this morning when we were putting the show together. How did it break out? Is this going to be over two segments, or are we going to do this all in one segment?
So Mike is going to be talking about the death penalty in the first segment for a few minutes, and then he's coming back on in Block B, so the second 15 minutes to talk about
the Keeling
play.
Okay, yes. Great. So it's staying the way we had thought. Yeah. And then Ted Cruz's dad thinks that Ted is going to be the king who's going to redistribute wealth in the end times?
Well, people thought Ted Cruz was crazy, but he might be crazier than you think. So Bruce,
or he might be crazy like a fox.
Yeah, I mean he's a smart guy, but he's definitely got. There's a lot I feel like we don't know about him, and it's unraveling as far our eyes. So definitely something your viewers will want to tune into. Bruce Wilson's going to be here talking with us from Massachusetts. He's going to be
right.
talking about that.
And for our geeky science segment, you won't believe what makes people stupid, and I mean not. Stupid, like the pejorative, but like dementia.
Yeah, a lot of people know that having high blood sugar is bad for your physical fitness, but it turns out it actually decreases your cognitive ability. We'll get into the science of that in our geeky science segment tonight.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to go through the pantry and throw out the cookies.
I don't know if you want to do that.
And our daily take on Denmark.
Yeah, Denmark is actually the happiest country in the world. Tiny little Denmark of about 6 million people. They've found a way to make society work and make people enjoy it. So we're going to be discussing why, what they've found out.
Right. There is one magic key to the whole thing. They've figured that out. We will talk about that tonight in The Big Picture. Nate Sweet, thanks for being with us, Nate.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. I want to talk with you about racism and the acculturation of racism for just a minute, if I can. And I want to share a personal experience with you and share an experience of somebody else. Something that happened to me yesterday provoked an evening of soul-searching and conversation with Louise that I want to share with you and get your thoughts on. And your experiences on. And we do have, you know, callers who want to talk about California secession and Republican economics and capital gains and Shelley Adelson and Iran and things like that. And we will get to those topics, too, as we go through the day. These are all legitimate topics for the day. But a couple days ago, a young man, 19-year-old African-American young man who's a student at the New York City College of Technology, his name is Trayon Christian, went shopping at Barney's. Now, I went shopping at Barney's once in my life. I've got this kind of really cool fuzzy hat that I have worn all over the world for 30 years that a friend of mine bought as a gift for me back years ago to celebrate. We had started a business, and it was like, hey, you know, here, this is really cool. So I've been to Barney's once, but it's like this really fancy, expensive men's clothing store in New York City. And Treyon had saved up $350 to buy this Ferragamo belt. And he, you know, for a long, long time, he'd been saving money from his job. And he finally had enough money. He went and he bought the belt. And as he's leaving the store, he gets arrested. And they take him to the police department. And he's got the receipt. He can prove he bought the belt. And they're saying there's something phony about this. You know, a guy like you wouldn't be buying a belt like this. What do you mean, a guy like me? Well, you're black. And, I mean, it may not have been said quite that. Well, actually, it was. The undercover officer said, quote, how can a young black man afford to purchase such an expensive belt? And now another case has come out. Now, this was not apparently a Barney's officer who did this. Barney's has disavowed this. They say, we don't do this kind of thing. But apparently it was a security guard who started the thing, and then the police got involved. And then there's another woman who just came out. Kayla Phillips, 21-year-old African-American, said that she, same thing. She bought a $2,500 handbag at Barney's and got four blocks away from the store before four cops basically tackled her. She says, I was walking to the train station. Four undercover police officers attacked me. They asked why I used a debit card and why it didn't have my name on it. She called her mom, and the cops had said, what are you doing here in Manhattan? Where'd you get the money for that bag? She apparently lives in, what, Brooklyn, I think? So here's what happened to me. Yesterday, I was taking the Metro over to the TV studio, and I walked out of the train car. And as I walked out of the train car, it was fairly busy. There was this kid who was just running down the platform. I mean, just running. He had his head down. He was running forward like, you know, like a football player runs. I mean, just yoom. Going as fast as he could. And I didn't see him coming. I just took one step out of the train, and the edge of the tip of his shoulder went right into my rib cage, knocked us both on the ground. I think I have a cracked rib. It hurts to cough like crazy. And anytime I move forward any little bit, it hurts. And, you know, who knows how he is. I mean, we helped each other up. His Bluetooth that was in his ear had fallen on the ground. And he didn't notice that. And I pointed it out to him. I said, your Bluetooth is there. And he got it. And he said, you okay? And I said, yeah. And I said, are you okay? And he said, yeah, I'm fine. And so he went on his way. He kept running down the platform. And I went up the stairs. And so I went home and I told Louise this story. And she said, boy, I'll bet he was late for like a job interview or something. I mean, he must have been really, really desperately running. And I said, well, I had thought that maybe he'd just like lifted somebody's iPhone and was being chased. And then I suddenly realized that, you know, this kid who hit me was black, who, you know, who ran into me. I mean, there was no malice, I'm sure, intended in this at all. He was just running and not paying attention. I don't think he was looking at me. I think he was looking down. And so apparently at some, you know, level, my own internal acculturated racism had kicked in, right? Black kid running, must be a crime. Had it been a white guy in a suit, I'm guessing I probably would have been thinking what Louise was thinking, and she was thinking that I had not told her the race of this kid. Now, here's the flip side of that. I was doing the TV show. We had a black guest on, a black conservative, and a white liberal. We were doing one of our debates, and the African-American conservative was making a point, and the liberal just cut him off in a very dismissive fashion, which this guy does with everybody. And the black guy looked like, whoa, like he'd just been slapped. And later he said, you know, did he talk to me like that because I'm black? And I'm like, no, he talks like that to everybody. And he said, well, you know, throughout my life, I just always wonder. Because you just never know. Did that guy cut in line in front of me because I'm black? Did that person talk to me that way? You know, and like that. And so it's like there's, you know, on both sides, right? There are these assumptions that people make about race that are that are grounded in the stories of our culture. They're grounded in the movies we see. They're grounded in the TV shows we see. They're grounded in our experiences as children. They're grounded in all this stuff. And I, you know, and it also caused me to wonder after when I said to Louise, you know, no, I thought he was running because, you know, he had, because there's a lot of snatch and grabs. The number one crime in Washington, D.C. right now is people snatching an iPhone out of your hand in the metro and running away. That's the number one crime. I've got a cracked screen on my iPhone and I keep it that way because I figured nobody's going to want to steal it. So that's why, you know, that also is part of why I thought he had just done that. And I didn't even think about that until afterwards. I mean, that was my assumption as I was going up the stairs. I wasn't even thinking about why. But I wonder what an African-American would have thought stepping out of the train and being run into and knocked to the ground by a young African-American. Would they have made the same assumption that I did, or would they have made the assumption that Louise did, that he was late for a job interview or a really important meeting or home or for dinner? What have your experiences been like this? I'm guessing a lot of you have had experiences like this that suddenly reveal to yourself your own unconscious biases or thoughts. Or
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or your own acculturation. I mean, we can't separate ourselves from the culture that we grew up in. We can try as hard as we want, but it's there. Past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I might not be projecting my voice as much as I normally do because every time, oh, there it goes again. Every time I talk loud, it hurts. I think I have a cracked rib. I know I have a bruised rib. I can tell you that. And I told you the story about that, and I wondered, do you have similar, you know, about my response to that and what it told me about myself, about how, you know, I've grown up and what, and it was frankly something that I don't want to say I'm embarrassed to admit. I'm okay telling you this story, but I'm kind of horrified that this is the way I think, or the way that my brain thinks before I think about thinking, if you know what I mean. And I'm just curious, you know, what your experiences have been. Lee in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom? I just want to make a comment about your experience yesterday. Mm-hmm. As a black person, which I am, we also experience those same kinds of thoughts. And I think it's the whole issue of internalized racism that blacks as well as whites have internalized. And those are the kind of thoughts that go through, you know, so it's not only you. Mm-hmm. Even as a black person, when I have, if I would have had that kind of experience, the first thing that probably would have gone through my mind before I started editing it would have been something similar to what you had.
Very interesting. Yeah.
So, it's something that I think it's like a disease. It's rampant in the whole society, and it affects everybody.
Okay.
Which leads me to, so I want to just in a minute bring up something that I think has been left out of the whole argument about race since 9/11, and that is the whole question of reparation. Because I think that until the whole issue of, you know, our history as black Americans is dealt with, and the whole question of unpaid labor, as well as the 100 years after slavery of being forced out of the economic and political parts of this society, until that is dealt with and struggled against, I don't think, I don't think that we're going to ever deal with the whole undercurrent of racism in this country.
Yeah.
As a person on the left, we talk about, maybe democratic socialism or some other kind of approach. But until that question is dealt with, I don't think the whole issue of racism will be settled. And if you've ever been to Cuba, I think you have some example of what I'm talking about. Even in a socialist society, mm-hmm. racism still runs rampant.
Yeah, there are light-skinned Cubans and dark-skinned Cubans, and there's a definite caste system there. I haven't been to Cuba, but I've seen that in other Central and South American countries where you have people of Spanish ancestry and people of indigenous ancestry or people of African ancestry or a mix of the two. And there's a pecking order that seems to be racially organized. I've seen that in Colombia. I've seen that in Brazil. I've seen that in Peru. I've seen that in Mexico. I've seen that in Ecuador. And that's where in Ecuador, you know, the president is a Native Ecuadorian, South American. And that's kind of a cool thing. It's a step in the right direction, but you're right. And this is where I think that, you know, like the Great Society was a start. Affirmative action was a more important start. Right now, the average net worth of an African-American family in the United States is around $5,000, and the average net worth of a white family in the United States is around $80,000. And until that disparity is done away with, we won't be all starting from the same starting point, no matter, you know, how much lip service we give and how many laws we pass. And some variation on reparations, I think, is entirely appropriate. And that's what I think good, effective affirmative action would be. And that's what's being dismantled right now by the Supreme Court, by the way. So,
Yeah. But I think also the struggle to bring that about will be important, because a lot of people, like I heard Congressman, the guy from Atlanta, Lewis,
John Lewis,
recently talking about this, and somebody brought up reparations, and he said, well, this is not the climate for it, you know, this is not a good time to talk about this. And I think that's how it's been dealt with at this point, but I think the struggle for it to bring up these arguments will be also just as important as the economic benefits that would possibly come from it.
I agree. And that's part of why I decided to talk about my own experience here on the radio today, is I want to start that conversation. Lee, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching us down there in New Orleans. John in how do you say your city name there in California, John?
Cayucos.
Okay, great.
What's Cayucos, up? Yeah. Listen, my wife and I own a business in the closest biggest town here, San Luis Obispo, central coast of California, and I had a very similar experience. I had decided to, I had to make a delivery for our business, and it was early in the morning, and, I pulled up to the business. The employees, were not there yet. And normally I would leave the package out in front of the business. Now, this business just happens to be across the parking lot from a homeless shelter, which, our business that we own has been very good at donating food to. But I pulled up, and there was a black guy, and I'm a 52-year-old white guy from Los Angeles, and I've been beat up by the best of them down there, gang members back in the 70s. And my dad kind of took a racist view on things. I never did. I never looked at it as the black community that was beating me up. I looked at it as that person that was doing that. And so I didn't hate the black population. I just hated those people, you know, that did that to me. And so this is mainly a pretty white town here. And but there's homeless people, of course. It's nice weather and stuff. They're here all the time. And there was a black guy standing out in front on a bicycle smoking a cigarette, and he appeared that he had just come from the homeless shelter. And normally I would have left the package of food out in front of this business. And normally I would leave my car running while I walked across the little walkway to get to the business. Well, I walked up and I said, okay, I don't know what this guy's up to. No one's around. I shut my car off, left the package in the car, and looked around to make sure that there was no employee there. And I decided to leave. And normally I would have left it. Well, I got home and I discussed this with my wife, because I felt like I did it because he was black. And if that was a white guy, I may not have done it. And the next day he was out there again. And I left the car running this time, and I said good morning to him. And he asked me, you know, how I was doing and all that kind of stuff. And I said, fine. And I said, so they're not open yet, huh? And I started a conversation with him. He was very intelligent. He was very nice. And I said, you know what? Screw this. I'm leaving the package. If he takes it, then he needs it. He didn't take it. As a matter of fact, he guarded it until the employees came and opened the store.
Yeah.
And what it did to me, it still to this day, and this happened maybe 2 months ago, I think about this almost daily because I, you know, I'm a total liberal. And like I said, I never thought of the black community as against me or against the whites. There's good white people. There's bad white people. There's good black people. There's bad black people. We're just people trying to live together.
Mm-hmm.
And
yet we've all got these acculturated instincts. John, a marvelous story. Thank you for sharing that with us.
I hope it doesn't happen again. I wish that I could get this out of me.
Well, I think the first step is talking about it and processing it, which is what we're all doing here. Now, thank you for sharing. Frank in Midway, Georgia. Hey, Frank.
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener. Like the conversation. I'm an African-American father, mid-50s. I got a son who's in college. Okay? I want to thank you for telling your story because I see it as an accident. That was just something that happened, but it was just an accident at that moment. But later on, you got to thinking about the circumstances and
right.
What was relevant and what wasn't, you know, and you came up to a conclusion. Now, my son is in college. Fortunately enough, I have enough money to take care of him. Buy him a nice car. He tells me he wants to buy a $300 pair of Air Jordan. Okay, I wire in the money, put it in his account. He takes his car. He gets hassled at the store about it. Where'd you get the money? What are you doing? Where do you work?
Uh-huh.
He called me up. I had to call the store, called me to verify it.
Wow.
So the account is in my name and his. And I was kind of shocked. Like, you know, he's a decent young man. He's typical. He's no different than anybody else, any 20-year-old out there.
Sure.
And it's amazing to me to think, you know, we're not equal.
Yeah. Yeah, this is something. I mean, you know, the President of the United States talked about, you know, his experience in his younger years of having people lock their doors as he walked by their cars. This is something this country needs to be talking about more. And Frank, thank you for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. We'll continue this conversation right after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, I think the really important things here are twofold. Number one, that we be having these conversations, and we generally avoid them. And number two, that we be talking about policy things that we can do to fix this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Edward in Southold, New York. Am I saying that right, Edward? Watching Free Speech TV?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you. The incident that we experienced, my wife and I, we were in Washington visiting, and we were walking along the street, and we saw in front of us a group of African Americans. There's about four or five of them. They were having a heated discussion, and it was a little bit loud, not necessarily angry. They were dressed, nothing about their dress made them stand out. We started to get closer. We were thinking, you know, maybe we were actually looking for a place where we might cross the street so we didn't have to pass them. But as we got a little bit closer, one of the fellows came toward us and said, can you help us out? We're having a discussion, and if somebody is president for two terms and then they were not president for a couple of years, could they come back and be president again? And so, you know, we answered the question as best we could. But
the answer, by the way, is no.
No, we knew that, but they didn't know that, but we felt the way we felt about our reaction to that, you know, thinking about maybe slightly changing our direction.
Right, when in fact what was going on is these guys were just having a reasonable political discussion, probably about the first African-American president being reelected, and can he come back again? Or maybe not. I mean, maybe it's racist of me to even assume that. I mean, they might have been, talking about George Bush.
I think one of the things that I think about is there tends to be more crime where there's poverty.
Yes.
And
there tends to be more poverty where there's racism is influencing the local population, which means that communities of color have higher percentages of poverty in the United States and around the world.
Right. So they have more crime and often are accused of having more attitude. Hmm. So which anybody would have if they have gone through some of the difficult experiences that they have.
Yeah. And if you look at immigrant populations in the United States, and you look at the history of them, I know Leo DiCaprio made a movie, which I have not yet seen, Gangs of New York, that was apparently about either the Italian or the Irish experience in New York City in the late 19th century. But, when there was a wave of Irish immigrants in the 1850s, around the Civil War time and then in the decades after, and then a wave of Italian immigrants in the 1880s, 1890s, these people came over very, very poor. There was a lot of poverty and a lot of crime in their communities. There were books written speculating about, the Irish criminal gene, the Italian criminal genetics. Is it possible that these people are just, naturally? But they were able to merge into the dominator culture, into the mass WASP culture, the white Anglo-Saxon culture, ultimately, because they were white. They did not have that, visible, you are one of them. Unless they maintained their accents, generation to generation. In some places they did. In parts of Boston, people talk in, differently. But I think that this is, I don't have a solution other than, I think, affirmative action. But I think that this is a conversation we need to be having. Edward, thank you for sharing your story. That's a very good one. Appreciate the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back 10 minutes before you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victor in Okeechobee, Florida. Hey, Victor, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to tell you a little story. I was raised the same way. I was raised around being a racist and all this, but in the 70s and the early 80s. But you know what? Every time I've ever broke down, the only person that's ever stopped and helped me out was an older black man.
You mean when your car broke down?
Yeah. Even in the pouring rain. Hmm. I'd have people coming by, splashing you, and the only person that's ever come to my rescue while I was out on the road has been an older black man.
Have you broken down on the road a lot, Victor? Are you a trucker or something, or?
No, I was
just drive a lot.
A guy that likes to travel around a little bit. My father was Air Force, so I traveled, every 4 years. And
sure.
So I've lived in a lot of different places. And
yeah. That's an interesting story. Have you changed your attitudes and opinions about race as a result of that?
Oh yeah, I really never had. I had that opinion up until like the seventh grade, and then I always wanted to have friends. I haven't had friends in high school and middle school with black people, and a lot of them are some of the greatest people in the world.
Very interesting.
Now my nieces, I have a. Grandnieces that are half black, and they're beautiful children, and it's hybrid. When you hybrids are always everything seems to be better when it gets to be a hybrid, even when you grow plants and stuff. When you cross plants and stuff like that, the new plants even seem to be better.
Yeah.
So,
very interesting.
This world will be better in another 20 years, 10 years.
I think America, you know, non-white babies are outnumbering white babies now in the United States, and I think this is a good thing for this country. Victor, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing that story with us. NJ in New York City. Hey, Brooklyn. Hey, NJ, what's up?
Tom, the scenario that you had brought up, it was strong in the 50s. I can remember born in the Caribbean and watching these farm workers coming over here in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come back, it's three things they used to speak about, which one of them was all right. And one of the things is running. Any African that is on the street running, the police would chase them, hold them, and they have to prove, why are you running? Who are you running from? What you stole? Even if they're running to school or to the job.
Right.
The second thing is jaywalking. Well, jaywalking kind of, although we couldn't understand why you're going to get arrested and get a ticket for walking across the street.
Right.
The other one that most of us could not believe, although those guys were telling the truth, is irate. You, as an African man, you could not turn your head and look at a European woman. You would be arrested for irate. We believe
irate, like eyeball rape.
Yes.
Whoa. Now these are people who are sharing with you the experience that they had in the Caribbean
No.
That they had in New York City when they got there.
Those were brothers who came over here as farm workers.
Uh-huh.
One of them was arrested. One is a Jamaican, was arrested, came out Saturday evening to hang out after work.
Right.
He was arrested, and when he went back to camp, the boss asked him, do you want a lawyer? And he says, no, I don't want any lawyer. I'm going in to defend myself. Everybody believing that he was going to be locked up, deported, and everything. He went in court, and he defended himself. Now, his defense was, Your Honor, Mr. Bustamante did not send any blind man over here. And if we were blind or have bad sight, the American government would not want us. So every man look on a woman in Jamaica. So I didn't know that I couldn't look on a woman. And I heard that there was a laugh in the court. And he walked out. When he went back to camp, they couldn't believe that he did the which was a stupid allegedly crime.
Yeah. This was in the 50s.
In the 50s.
Yeah.
No, the brother that...
Well, that's how Emmett Till got, you know, or what the rationale, I guess, for killing Emmett Till, for torturing and killing Emmett Till, was that he whistled at a white woman.
Right.
Or no, maybe just looked at a white woman. Who knows?
The brother that gives his son $250 for the sneakers, and he and his son was annihilated, disgraced, and everything. I'm sitting here listening for him to do one sensibly intelligent thing, and he did not. Now, all I would do, Tom, after I've finished drug through the mud and disgrace and everything, I take my son to the counter with the police and everybody around me, and just put it down on the counter and said, may I have my 200 and... Not even me, because it's on as if I'm going to be asking. Says, I need my $250 now.
Mm-hmm.
Give them back their sneakers and walk out of the store. But the brother did not do that. He was too rich.
Well, we don't know. We don't know. I get your point. I would be inclined to take it a step further. I mean, both of these young African Americans who have been stopped at Barney's for shopping while black, they're both suing. And I think that that's one of the ways you stop this kind of behavior, is you make it painful, economically painful, for white people to make these assumptions and discriminate against black people. And so I would say to him, call a good lawyer. But I get your point, NJ. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WWRL. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I started off in the last hour. I mean, we talked about secession. We've talked about, what's going on in the U.S. House of Representatives. This is totally bizarre. In fact, we've got a clip of this that I need to share with you. This is... You do, yeah. We've got the video of this. This is a Congressman Frank Pallone of New York. And, you know, they're holding this hearing. The Republicans are holding a hearing in the House of Representatives into what went wrong with the Obamacare website. And, they're trying to ask questions in that are you still beating your wife questions, you know? When did you know that this was going to be a total disaster? Well, I never said it was going to be a total disaster. You know, when did, you know, that kind of thing, right? And here is Frank Pallone saying, no, I'm not going to play this game. He's the Democrat from New Jersey.
Information being provided that's not in play here today. No health information is required in the application.
Actually, stop that for a second, Jim, and let me just Jim, pause that for a minute, and let me just set this up. The Republican who preceded Frank Pallone had said on the record that he was concerned that that Obamacare was going to cause people's medical records to get out in the public, that this website not working was going to cause people's medical records to get into the public. Now, anybody who's looked at the website knows that it doesn't ask for your medical records. In fact, the whole point of Obamacare is that your medical records are irrelevant. You're not, you know, pre-existing conditions do not prevent you from getting insurance. So there are no questions about your health other than whether or not you're a smoker. That's it. That's the only question that they ask. But the Republicans are all hysterical about people's private confidential records are going to get out, which is, you know, a Fox News talking point, but there's absolutely no truth to it. And so, once again, here's Frank Pallone speaking to that.
Information being provided, that's not in play here today. No health information is required in the application process. And why is that? Because pre-existing conditions don't matter. So once again, here we have my Republican colleagues trying to scare everybody.
Will the gentleman yield?
No, I will not yield to this monkey court or whatever this thing is.
This is not a monkey court.
Do whatever you want. I'm not yielding. I am trying to tell you that the problem here,
protecting American citizens,
no pre-existing conditions,
legitimate concern of this committee.
The pre-existing conditions don't matter. HIPAA doesn't apply. There's no health information in the process. You're asked about your address, your date of birth. You're not asked health information. So why are we going down this path? Because you are trying to scare people so they don't apply, and so therefore the legislation gets delayed or the Affordable Care Act gets defunded or it's repealed. That's all it is. Hope.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. I mean, that's so he's but this monkey. I think he meant to say kangaroo Congress, but I don't know. Anyway, so that's going on and that's going to be in the news tonight. And it's just, you know, this is just bread and circus, right? This is just spectacle that the media is going to love. It's an interesting piece. I shared this story of my own collision with my own racist assumptions, which are built into, I think, all of us by our culture, I'm in pain as I'm doing the show. I think I have either a cracked or a bruised rib. I know it's bruised. In fact, it's looking kind of funky. Because a kid ran into me yesterday as I got out of the subway, out of the metro, and he was running down the platform just like a bat out of hell. He was running so fast, and I just stepped out of the train, and you know, bang! The point of his shoulder went right into my left rib cage, and it knocked us both on our butts. And you know, we helped each other get up, and he asked me if I was okay. I asked him if he was okay, and you know, he had dropped his Bluetooth, and I saw it, and he didn't. I don't think he'd realized I showed him where it was, and then you know, he left, and I was going up the stairs. And as I was going up the stairs, I was thinking, you know, I wonder why he was running. I wonder if this was one of those snatch and grabs where they're stealing iPhones in the subway. And when I got home, I told Louise about this kid who had run into me. Why was I, you know, making noises as I eased myself onto the couch, and you know, going ow. And she said, wow, he must have been really late for a meeting or something, or for a job interview. And I'm like, no, I thought he just snatched an iPhone. You know, or this is what I was thinking as I was on the escalator going up, you know, to the top of the metro. I mean, I didn't even think about it when it happened. There was just, you know, bang, you know, is he okay? Am I okay? That was the only thing that was going through my mind at the moment that it happened. But afterwards, as I was reflecting on it, that was the first conclusion that came to my mind. And when I told Louise the story, it was not the first conclusion that came to her mind, because when I told her the story, I didn't tell her that he was African American. And that's when I realized, as I realized how different her response was to mine, that there was some sort of racism in me that was informing my assumptions about this. And I think we all need to confront these demons. We need to confront this consequence of our culture, with this consequence of inequality in our society, this consequence of the black genocide in America that is still echoing today. So over at, it's interesting, Huffington Post has an interesting piece by Zoe Triska about words that have a racist or prejudiced origin and you have no idea. Gyp. To cheat or swindle. I always knew that was short for gypsy. I didn't know Irish goodbye. Actually, I've never heard that phrase. But it's a stereotype. Soul down the river. I never realized that soul down the river had to do with slaves that were hard to manage got literally sold down the river to plantations in the deeper South where they would treat them much more violently. Peanut gallery. I never realized that peanut galleries came from the upper balconies where the African Americans sat in the segregated theaters. Uppity, I think everybody knows uppity. Hip hip hooray was originally a shepherd's herding cry. German citizens began using it as a rallying cry while hunting for Jews. Back in 1819, they were called the Hep Hep Riots. And, of course, calling a spade, I had always assumed that was a reference, you know, the ace of spades being the number one card in some card games, a reference to that. But obviously, you know, there are people who have always thought of that and as being a African-American slur. So, anyhow, I thought that was interesting. But what do we do about this? And I'll pick up your calls right after. We're going to hit a break here in a little less than a minute. So right after that, I'll pick up your calls on this. But if you look at what causes these kinds of assumptions, I mean, obviously there's a certain amount of kind of built-in tribalism to all of us. We all look for people who are different from us in size, in build, in clothing, in dress, in class, in race. And that's just, that's a human instinct, right? Family first. But kind of a biological imperative that we see all across the mammals, you know, all mammals. But beyond that, the average household wealth of an African-American family in the United States is around $5,000. The average household wealth of a white family in the United States, these statistics are before the crash of 2008, so I don't know what they are right now, but you know, 10 years ago, was around $80,000. Most of that in household value, but 80 grand. That's a huge disparity. And it's the direct consequence of 100 years of so-called separate but equal, 100 years of segregation, 100 years of apartheid, that followed 300, 400 years of a slavery holocaust, of murder and rape and being considered property and perhaps most importantly, being completely cut off from the roots to your ancestors. I mean, I can go back and learn Norwegian, the country my father came from. It's still that, you know, I know who my ancestors are. Most African Americans don't. This is really core stuff.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we clean this up? I think that we really need to be having a conversation about affirmative action and not about doing away with it, but about aggressively pushing reparations, essentially. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Valerie in San Diego, California, listening to iHeartRadio. Hey, Valerie, what's up?
Hi. I follow the common thread and some of the earlier callers that is, I think, a great solution is to communicate with people. Just go up and talk to people, especially if you think you're going to be afraid of them or whatever. I mean, I've done this as a female. I have to overcome fear sometimes in certain situations, and I just talk to people, and then all guards drop on both sides. Everybody becomes friendly, and it's so much easier to deal with people if you just talk to them.
Well, and that brings up a whole other piece of this, which, you know, I can't speak to as a man, but, you know, what's the experience of women in this society looking at men, regardless of race?
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of ramifications. And, you know, being a female, even though I'm not black, I can still, I put myself into that place so that I can understand possibly where they're coming from because, yes, I'm 55 and I know that, you know, there's lots of times in my life, you know, my generation where, you know, people have put me down just for being a female.
Right. Misogyny is as alive and well as racism. And yeah, I think that you could argue Barack Obama beating Hillary Clinton to the White House, that misogyny may even be stronger than racism, although you could also argue that, you know, one campaign did a better job than another campaign. But misogyny and racism, misogyny being a fancy word for hating women, is alive and well in the United States too. Valerie, excellent point. We need to have this conversation. That's why I'm doing this on the radio today. As embarrassing is the wrong word, but you know, revealing yourself is just uncomfortable as it may be for me to share with you what went through my mind because I'm frankly ashamed of it. Johnny in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Johnny.
Yeah, Tom, that was a good lead into my comments. I'm real nervous, so I just wanted to say that, you know, I've let cultural differences come between me and my family. I've noticed if I decide I don't like them or something, I look for the differences that they have, and it becomes more of a tribal kind of thing. For me, I think when I maybe am thinking I'm going to put myself in a situation where I feel like I'm going to war with them or something, and I've let it drive, you know, a wedge between, you know, my family, I know, and it's almost been uncontrollable. But at the same time, I stopped listening to a lot of people that yell at each other on the radio and on TV in politics, and I just listened to a couple select people, you being my favorite, and I've learned a lot of tolerance, I think, on how to deal with people by listening to you, you know, that you don't agree with about such weighty issues that you speak about. You know, these are issues that everybody believes in with all their heart. You know, I just have to keep reminding myself that they all want a better world just like we do. They just think differently because they're different.
Yeah.
But listening to you, the way you can handle yourself and everything with people on the radio on the opposite side, sometimes they get a little, you know, start talking faster, whatnot. And that's always what I used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to relearn how to, some communication skills, you know, how to deal with people of the opposite party. Mm-hmm. And you're really just, you know, lighting the way up for me here in the kitchen today by myself. Well, I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you. That's awesome.
I mean, you're a great friend, and I don't even know you.
Well, thank you. That's very kind, and it's very nice to hear from you, and thanks for your comments. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I don't think that prejudice against African American people is, you know, endemic to any one area, of course. Mm. And I even went to a school that was somewhat integrated, but I also too grew up in the 50s and 60s, and I could say that I did not have any black friends. I did have some black teachers, and they were very good. I enjoyed learning from them. But, you know, I think that experiences growing up and what your parents tell you really have a very big impact. And my father was rather. And also, I wanted to say that I do think that there's just seems to be a tendency for people in a competitive society to be excluded. And I don't know, you know, I think prejudice is just one way to get rid of, one group of people. And mm-hmm. I know a lot of Italians and Jews that lived in New York trying to break into higher professions and teaching and a lot of different things were excluded. Mm-hmm. Even up into the 50s, there was a lot of prejudice because of the way they looked. You know, they didn't actually look WASPy. They looked rather Italian and Jewish.
And John, I got to tell you, that's still alive and well. And it's not just prejudice against African Americans. There's in every class and in every sector of society. You're absolutely right, John. Thanks for the call. And thanks for pointing that out. Jane in Seattle. Hey, Jane.
Hi, Tom. I really wish you hadn't left us in the Northwest and moved over to that cesspool over there.
Well, I'm living in the district of the goddess, Jane.
I last saw you on the Argus again. You ain't been back since.
Yeah, well, one of these days. I'm trying to get out to Seattle next month because I've got a book tour coming up.
Okay. Oh, fantastic. We'd love to see you.
We'll keep you up to date on that.
I wanted to talk about your underlying reasons and hidden wisdoms about why you think we need slow democracy to change this horrible rush toward genocide in the last hour that we have going on here. But since we need to confine the discussion to racism, I'd like to say that I'm a 65-year-old woman who was raised by a single mom in Chicago, in various environments in Chicago, lived in Seattle over 40 years because I love it here. However, I would like to have thought that my mother brought me up non-racist, but and such was the case with African Americans, but I remember the occasional slur against Jews in Chicago coming into the conversation. Yeah. So I think I know that all of us have been in some way, shape, or form through our environment conditioned into the racisms that have been fed to us.
I agree, Jane, and that's what we need to be talking about. Thank you for your call. And we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How do we get through this? You know, inequality has a lot to do with this. Check out the book, The Spirit Level, on that. Bad and the very, very Punaluanly ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, Vicki Thomas. When this Miami-Dade police officer stopped local woman Jessica Robles for shoplifting from the Publix grocery store, she could have had her arrested. When Thomas found that Robles was struggling to make ends meet, she held back and instead bought her $100 worth of groceries. WSBN-TV covered the story for local television.
Came out and asked, do you even have food at the house? And I looked at her, you know, in her face, and I told her no, at all.
I made the decision to buy her some groceries because arresting her wasn't going to solve the problem with her children being hungry. So I went in and bought her some groceries.
$100 worth of groceries?
Yes, $100.
Well done, Officer Thomas. The bad, Chris McDaniel. The Mississippi State Senator is your classic Tea Party insurgent. He's running against veteran Senator Thad Cochran because he thinks Cochran surrendered to Democrats by voting to reopen the government last week. Well, it turns out that McDaniel might be an actual insurgent, as in the rebel yelling Dixieland kind of insurgent. According to an article in Mother Jones, McDaniel has spoken at neo-Confederate conferences as recently as August. One of the groups that organized that conference, the Jones County Rosenheels, warned in an August newsletter that we are living in the times that Jefferson Davis predicted would one day come in. Let me start that over again. We are living in the days that Jefferson Davis predicted would one day come in, which the conflicts that presaged the Civil War would flare up again. End quote. Wow. So much for that whole Party of Lincoln thing, huh? And the very, very ugly Sonoma County Police. The Northern California Police Department is under fire today for killing 13-year-old Andy Lopez. Its officers shot Lopez, pictured here, to death on Tuesday when they mistook his pellet gun for an AK-47. Sonoma County law enforcement officials are now trying to explain their actions by saying that Lopez turned and pointed his pellet gun toward the cops. But let's be honest. It's just another example of shoot first, think later policing. Somewhere along the line, our country forgot that the first duty of a police officer is to protect and serve, not to act as judge, jury, and executioner. And that is very, very ugly. Leslie in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Leslie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
I was calling because I was listening earlier, and the lady was talking about how she said that she talks to people, and that makes her feel a little bit better if you get to know someone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had an experience the other day. I was in my car. I was sitting in the parking lot, and I saw a guy, like, out the corner of my eye who kind of looked like a vagrant, if you will. He looked maybe homeless. And so I rolled up my window and I locked my door. And I'm an African-American woman, but this man was actually Caucasian. And I thought to myself, maybe I was being, stereotypical of him because of the way he looked or the way he was dressed. And after I thought of that, had he been black, white, Asian, you know, any color, I probably would have done the same thing had it been that situation.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's so this kind of consciousness and fear is not just limited to race. It's limited to it extends to class, arguably, as well. And
I would say, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. Last week, the study came out that showed that for, the fifth, sixth, seventh year in a row now, Denmark is the happiest country in the world. And when you look at the difference between Denmark and America, in fact, the first time this came out, we took our show on the road. And back in, I think it was 2006, we did our show for 2 weeks from Denmark. Or for a week, rather, from Copenhagen. Danish radio loaned us studios and talked to all kinds of politicians and people. And what we discovered is that they have very little inequality in Denmark. There is virtually no really severe poverty or homelessness, and there are very, very few billionaires. I think there might be one in the whole country or two truly rich people. I mean, just profoundly rich people. Most everybody in Denmark is the middle class. And it's you know, Danes are white, but there actually is a fair amount of racial diversity in their society. They've had a lot of immigration in there since World War II. And everybody's in the middle class. And so there is not so much, there's more social trust. This is the great stuff that came out of this study that Wilkinson and Pickett did that you can read over at equalitytrust.org.uk or in their book, The Spirit Level, is that a more equal society is a society where people are more likely to trust each other. And we live in one of the most unequal societies in the world. And so we have in America the lowest level of trust of each other and trust of government. And I think that, Leslie, your story is, you know, kind of a reflection, is a micro reflection of that macro thing. We're seeing it played out in our politics, too. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I absolutely agree with you. Yeah.
Leslie, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing your story. I appreciate it. David in New York City. Hey, David, what's up?
Yes. Nice to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you.
A big fan. I've been a hairdresser for 53 years. I'm retired now, and I had a shop for about 28 years in the middle of Manhattan on the Upper East Side. And there was a time when I said, gee, I could use another hairdresser. And it has occurred to me that what happened if a black hairdresser came into the shop and looking for work. And I was surrounded by a white community, at least mostly white. and my clientele was white. Well, and I knew that if a black hairdresser came in and looking for work, in my own business head, wouldn't be the right thing to do as far as a businessman is concerned, because I would assume, maybe that's wrong, that most people wouldn't like the idea in the community I was. So, and I don't think of myself as a racist at all. So it was a dilemma, and it occurred to me that I would not hire a black hairdresser. So did that make me a racist? Would you think?
Well, I think I understand your thinking, and I think that it is racist. Yeah, I think that's the essence of the subtle. This is the problem with racism. Most racism is not, you know, the stereotype of the, you know, the white guy from down south looking for some person of color to stomp on in the gutter. You know, that most racism is nothing like that. Most racism is the subtle kind of stuff that you just described. And frankly, I think, you know, the experience that I had of leaping to conclusions, negative conclusions based on race. And, you know, somebody, a black person running, what is it? You know, oh, must have, you know, just snatched an iPhone or something. And that's the kind of subtle racism that we need to be really aware of. So I'm guessing you never had an opportunity to hire or turn down for employment.
That's true. I was scared. I was frightened to have a black man come in looking for a job.
Yeah.
I just would be beside myself.
Well, I'm impressed by your level of self-reflection, David, that you could game that scenario in your head and then be horrified by the outcome of it. But, yeah, that, and this is how people, I mean, even presumably decent person like yourself, participates, you know, it's like we're all good Germans, you know, participates in this, in a system that perpetuates the separation that perpetuates the disparity in income. I mean, how does an African-American break into the, I'm guessing as a hairdresser on the Upper East Side, you were making a whole lot more than a hairdresser would in Harlem, right?
That's true. That's true. But I worked for Sassoon also, and we had in Sassoon a black hairdresser, but it was a higher class of clientele. And the shop was a very high class salon on Madison Avenue. And, there weren't people that were shy against, a black hairdresser working on them. Not in that, but I was working between 2nd and 1st Avenue, which had sort of a middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was, beside myself thinking that I just wouldn't do it. I just couldn't do it.
Very, very interesting. David, thanks for sharing your story. Dave, in Arcata, California, just a minute to the break, Dave, can you tell your story quickly?
Oh, well, some very excellent topics this morning, Tom. I'm calling you from Humboldt County, and that we're one of two of the most progressive liberal counties in the country, as I understand it. We're one of two counties that voted to impeach Bush and Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
We have more registered Greens and Republicans. In these counties, corporations are not people. My main concern is that I feel that elections being rigged as they are, we end up with 4 out of 5 of our Board of Supervisors being kind of right-wing whacks. And how does that happen? What can we do about it? I'm feeling a bit rushed, but I haven't heard the music yet.
Yeah. I think that what we do about that is we get money out of politics, and that's coming out of Humboldt County as well. You know, David Cobb and the whole MoveToAmend.org started in Humboldt County, and I believe. And so there's some good stuff that can be done. Dave, thanks for the call. 15 minutes before the hour.
Yeah. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Racism, what do we do about it? How do we solve this problem? How do we take this cancer out of our culture? And welcome back. Ken in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Ken, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. What's up?
Yeah, Tom, thank you for taking my call. You've caused me to do a lot of soul searching today. And I've noticed that I don't consider myself a racist. I love jazz music and a lot of black people and things like that. But what really triggers me is the way some people talk with like a drawl.
Yeah.
You know, and I see movies where black people from England talk with a British accent, and it totally throws my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then I find it's the speech that triggers me.
Right. Right, that evokes stereotypes in your mind that are negative stereotypes. Yeah, I think that's a fairly common experience. I think that's a very common experience. Ken, thanks for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. John in Bellevue, Michigan. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I've been a musician all my life. I came from a military family. I lived in the Marine Corps for 18 years. I didn't know what racism was. As a matter of fact, up until I was 4 years old, I thought everybody's dad was in the service. Okay. And, but I've been a professional musician since 65. And, we had an occurrence in, 69 or 70, I believe. I hooked up with a soul band from Riverside, California, from Battle Creek, Michigan. We went over to a totally black room in Kalamazoo, the Ambassador Lounge, the biggest club they got in Kalamazoo, all black. I pulled up, we were supposed to audition, okay? So, and we had two Mexican horn players, two white boys, and me on drums, and that was our band. Mm-hmm. And we walked into this
room. And you're white.
Room. Pardon me? Yeah, I'm white.
Yeah, okay.
And I pulled up to the corner, the club was at the corner, and there was about 200 black people across the corner, and they threw a pop bottle and hit me right in the grill of my van. Okay. I said, well, to hell with this noise, and I turned left, and I went on to home. And I had never been racist at all. Within an hour, I had a big Cadillac Fleetwood at my front door, which was the owner of the club, who came and picked me up in Battle Creek, took me right back to the club. We played our gig, which was about four-song set. And got off that, they fired a black band and hired us, and we were there for the next 2 weeks, and I met some of the greatest people I ever met in my life. And I'll tell you, music soothes the savage beast, and that's it.
You know, all of us, regardless of race.
Absolutely.
The music is the universal language.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And a lot of the early stuff that cut across race in America, my dad, you know, Louis Armstrong was probably his favorite musician in the world. My dad played the trumpet when he was in high school, and he worshipped Louis Armstrong. I mean, you know, we played Louis Armstrong music at my dad's funeral, and I wonder if that influence when the white girl next door to us decided to marry a black man, and her own father refused to walk her down the aisle. And my dad said, I'll do that. And he did. He walked her down the aisle. And that family was so upset with my parents that they moved away from the neighborhood. I wonder, to what extent Louis Armstrong informed my dad's decision. I don't know. Tom, thanks for sharing that story. Oh, wait a minute. That wasn't Tom. Thanks for sharing that story. And with us now is the president of Gingrich Productions, the author of Ellis the Elephant, historical children's books. The latest is Yankee Doodle Dandy. The website is gingrichproductions.com. Calista Gingrich. Calista, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Or Mrs. Gingrich. Or
call me Calista.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. This book, first of all, why Ellis the Elephant?
Well, in writing children's books, you need an interesting and unique character to capture their attention. And I did consider many animals, including bunnies and hippos and giraffes. And in the end, I could not resist this adorable little elephant Ellis the Elephant, who was brought to life beautifully by my illustrator, Susan Arciero.
Right. No, no, you didn't consider donkeys, did you?
I didn't.
I figured. Okay. You say that this book, I'm sorry, I apologize that I haven't had an opportunity to read the book. And I try to do that when I have people on, but for some reason we didn't get this from your publicist.
Okay. Well, no worries. This book is really about patriotism and our nation's humble beginnings. It's not a Republican book or a conservative book, but mm-hmm. a pro-American book. And I really hope it will appeal to all American families as a celebration of our patriotism and of our nation.
Yeah. You cover the Boston Tea Party. Do you point out that that was a revolt against the largest corporation in the world at that time?
Well, we don't say it that way for 4 to 8 year olds, but we do go through the pivotal moments that have defined the American Revolution.
Yeah.
This is the third volume in my Ellis the Elephant series, and the series offers a guided tour of American history for 4 to 8 year olds. And in this book, Ellis the Elephant, who is my time-traveling pachyderm, discovers the American Revolution and how America became a free and independent nation.
That is absolutely great. Calista, keep writing good books.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. I much appreciate it. And welcome back. That was a clip of an interview that we actually recorded yesterday, but I wanted to share with you. Keith in Elgin, Illinois, listening on WCPT. You wanted to tell us about your experience with racism as coming from English? England? Keith, you are on the air. Keith? Is not there. Let's try Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul. Thanks for listening to KBCS.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to tell my tale of how I believe that racism and bigotry begins with ignorance, and it did in my case.
Mm-hmm.
As a 12-year-old boy many years ago when I was in the 7th grade, I had a math teacher who I loved. Her name was Mrs. Goldfarb, and I loved her because she was drop-dead gorgeous. She was a really fun teacher, and she was kind of short, so she was about eye level with us junior high kids, which made it me think that it was, might be possible that I could marry Miss Goldfarb. And I was at the time, she let us talk to our friends while we were doing our problems, and I was telling my friend I wanted to buy an electric guitar, and my friend said, and my mom said I'd have to come up with half the money, and my friend said, well, why don't you get a paper route? And I said, oh, okay. But he said he had one. And I said, well, how much do you make? And he said, well, it depends on if the customers want to pay. It was some kind of paper that was optional payment.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you mean they don't have to pay and you deliver it? And I said, you're getting chewed. And Mrs. Goldfarb came over to me and tore my head off and said the word Jude is not a popular word in this classroom. I don't ever want to hear. She was yelling at me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea why. I thought, boy, that's a cuss word. I never thought. I thought I must have said the F word or worse yet, the C word. Later on, I got a note to come and see my counselor, and my counselor said that Mrs. Goldfarb would like me to find another math teacher. And I said, but why? I really like her. And he said, well, she wants you. So he said, who would you like to go into? Whose classroom? I said, I'd like to go into Mr. Hardy's classroom. I like him. He said, Mr. Hardy was black, by the way. And he said, I don't know if that's a good idea. And I said, well, why? He said, well, I said, you said I could choose, and he let me go into Mr. Hardy's room, and I had a good time in Mr. Hardy's room, and at the end of the year, he said, you need to bring the book back, or the book needs to go back to Mrs. Goldfarb's class, and he said, would you like to bring it, or should I? And I said, I don't know, and he said, well, yeah, I think you should. I brought it back, and she was just as happy and cheerful. This whole time, I never knew why. This had happened until I was in college with my first year at Michigan State. I had a girlfriend who was Jewish, and she told me, she said, I'm a Jew. And I said, wait, that word had never passed my lips since the 7th grade. I said, what does that mean? And she said, well, that's my religion and my ethnicity. And she explained to me about Judaism, and I told her the story about Mrs. Goldfarb, and she explained to me about the stereotype and why that word was offensive. And right then and there, at 19 years old, I wept. I thought, I can't believe that I hurt this person so terribly. And I still feel that way today. I wish that I could run into that person and tell her how badly I feel, I still feel, about the ignorant thing that I said. And, Tom, I was not a well-informed person in those days. I was just starting college. But from that time on, I decided I don't use words that I don't know what they mean. And I came across a lot of other things, like the word gypped, you know, gypsy, Jewish gypsy.
Yeah.
Welsh, I don't use words like that, and I think a lot of people use words that are hurtful because they're ignorant and they need to become informed and educated.
Yeah. Brilliant story, Paul. Thanks for calling and sharing that story with us. That's a deep one. Thank you so much. Dick in Great Falls, Montana. Dick, we just have a minute to the end of the hour. Can you tell your story quickly?
I will. Hi, Tom. Talk to you. I went to Vietnam when I was a kid in the Marines, the whole thing. And after basic training, we went to advanced infantry training, which basically is supposed to get you ready to go in country. And one of the friends I made there was a black man named Sterling. And so it was coming up to the end. I had a friend that lived down there in Riverside. So he came to get us from Camp Pendleton, and we were up in L.A. having a good time. And we're looking for a place to stay because it was nighttime and we were cold. And, you know, so we're going around to different motels, and everybody was full. It's like, what's going on? Everything's full. And so we got to this one, and Sterling goes, you know, I'm just too tired. I'm not moving. Can you guys go get a room? It's like, sure. So we went and got a room. And the guy said, well, who's your friend? And we said, just another guy. He's sleeping in the back of the car. So we went in and we got the room. And I said to Sterling, isn't it great? We finally got a room. And he goes, you don't have a clue, do you? I said, about what? He goes, we didn't get a room because I'm a black man. And it's like, what? And it hit me at that point. But there really is two cultures in this society. And yeah. I didn't have access to it. I grew up in Montana. I didn't know black people.
Yeah, and you hadn't experienced the discrimination that black people experience until you were with one. Remarkable story, Dick. Thank you for sharing that, and thanks for getting it into a minute. I'm really impressed. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So President Obama is giving a speech about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, and there's a woman standing immediately behind him who, it turns out, I guess was pregnant. And about three-quarters of the way through her speech, and she'd probably been standing there for an hour before he got up on the stage, because that's how those things go. You know, everybody has to get through security, and then you get, you know, where, anyhow. She fainted, or she was about to faint. Her name is Carmel Allison. And President Obama reached over and kind of helped her stay upright and made a joke about talking too long. And somebody came up and escorted her off the dais. And the Weekly Standard was apparently the first major website to say that this was all staged. Right. And Sarah Palin is like, well, you can understand why, right? I mean, because obviously that president, you know, he lies to us. I mean, this is my characterization of her characterization of him, but what she said was, that she can't blame people for buying the idea. Very bizarre. Here's what she wrote. With the Obama White House's total lack of transparency, it's no wonder that some will ask whether they've staged even a fainting lady in the Rose Garden. What was once a major leap in logic has become a single step because President Obama has lied so often and so blatantly. If you like your health care plan, you can keep your plan, comes to mind. End of quote from Sarah Palin. This is genuinely bizarre. And I'm convinced that an awful lot of this, and I don't, you know, it may well be that Sarah Palin in her heart of hearts doesn't think of herself as a racist. But I believe that we would not see, I mean, the Tea Party happened right after the first black president was elected here in the United States, or right after he took office in 2009. That's when the Tea Party started. Alan Grayson is out there saying, this is the Klan. They're actually, what the first thing he said was they're more popular than the Klan, or they've got about the same popularity as the Klan. And then, you know, everybody was jumping all over him, including Democrats. I mean, Claire McCaskill came out today and said it was deplorable what he said. I think what he said was right on. And I wish Democrats would speak out more often like this and push the edges of propriety and say things that some people might consider outrageous and therefore get in the news cycle. I mean, here you have Sarah Palin calling the president of the United States a liar, a serial liar. And so guess what? Sarah Palin gets all these news hits. She's the news cycle. She sells a few million more books. She makes more money. Her politics and her political position gets pushed out there. There's another slur on Obama and Obamacare that gets out there. Alan Grayson does it, and everybody's like, oh, Democrats don't talk like that. And Grayson is calling out racism. And Sarah Palin, whether she's, you know, doing this out of a racist intention or whether or not, it's still dog whistle to the racists. I told the story earlier in the program about how yesterday I got out of the subway. I stepped out of the train onto the platform at the Metro here in Washington, D.C. And this kid was just running down the platform really, really fast, you know, zooming through between people. And as I stepped out of the train car, he ran right into me. In fact, I think I might have cracked a rib. I'm certain I have a bruised rib. The tip of his shoulder just, you know, bang right into my chest, and it knocked us both to the ground. And we helped each other up, and we asked each other, "Are you okay?" And everything was fine. And he went on his way, and I went up the escalator. And as I'm going up the escalator, the thought that popped into my head, you know, why was this kid running? Well, he probably just snatched an iPhone. This is the number one crime in Washington, D.C. right now is stealing iPhones in the subway. It's the most common thing, apparently, that's other than probably drug dealers or something. But it's just a really common thing. And the reason why is there's these machines in the malls where you drop an iPhone in and they give you $200 cash for it. And so there's a big business in them. I got a cracked screen on my iPhone. I keep it that way because I figure somebody's going to look at my phone and think, I'm not going to steal that one. So, yeah, I get home, and I'm telling Louise this story, and her immediate response was he must have been late for a meeting or a job interview or something. It must be something going on. What's the deal out there? Nothing. Okay. And, you know, that there must be something going on. And it suddenly hit me how my response was so different from Louise's because I hadn't told Louise that this kid was black. Which says that my internal thinking process has been tainted by my own racism or racial bias or something. You know, my growing up, my whatever. And that really caused me to slow down and think, whoa, am I who I thought I was? And I think we all need to be confronting those stories and those demons. And I think that we also need to be joining Alan Grayson in confronting the overt racists. I mean, this kid who shows up with a Confederate flag at the White House, and nobody in that Tea Party group was condemning him. Nobody went up and took that Confederate flag down. His picture went all around the world. We got a problem in this country. And what makes it worse is the inequality in our country. The average white family has $80,000 worth of assets. The average black family has $5,000 worth of assets. Well, the average white family didn't, you know, their ancestors didn't go through 400 years of slavery and 100 years of apartheid, which only ended, by the way, a generation ago. I mean, ended in the when I was a child. Brown v. Board, 1954, I was 3 years old. Civil Rights Act, 1965, 66, the Voting Rights Act, you know, I was 14, 15 years old. I lived to see it, right? And my parents certainly, you know, lived through it. And you just, and then we get the Supreme Court now. In these affirmative action cases, which might remedy some of this situation. Now, on top of this, you know, yesterday I was talking about this study that showed that children who grow up in poverty are actually neurologically damaged by the poverty. I mean, they're also emotionally and intellectually damaged. They have a 30% smaller vocabulary at the age of three. But they're also neurologically damaged in utero by poverty. And I'm not talking about bad nutrition. I'm talking about the stress of poverty. I mean, there's the bad nutrition on top of that, and then there's you know, unequal access to good schools. You just add all this stuff together, and we are creating a rigidified society. In fact, the United States, among the 32, 34, whatever the OECD countries, the most developed countries in the world, we are next to last in terms of social mobility. The United States is one of the two countries in the world where you are most likely to die in the economic class into which you were born. And it was not that way when Ronald Reagan became president. We were at the top of social mobility 32 years ago. And now we're at the bottom of social mobility. We were at the top of social trust. People trusting each other. And thus politicians collaborating and cooperating and people collaborating and cooperating and people not having knockdown, drag out political battles and shutting down governments and stupid stuff like that. But instead trusting each other and cooperating with each other. So our inequality has gotten worse, and that exacerbates the racism, which exacerbates the inequality. And we're in this downward spiral as a consequence of this. And then out comes the Tea Party celebrating it. And then Alan Grayson criticizes it, and we're criticizing him?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, it's time to, number one, I think it's time to say thank you to Alan Grayson. And it's time, number two, for all of us to do some serious soul search. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to share a story about racism? Frank, can you hear me? Okay, I think this is another. You got to listen to your phone, not your TV or your radio, because there is a time delay. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny.
Oh man. Okay. Great show, Tom. You're definitely earning your donations this week. I would urge all my.
By the way, all those donations. Viewers. All those donations. Well. In any case, yeah. Let's not get into it. Okay, as you were saying, Johnny.
Yeah, great conversation, and it's because of content that you provide and Free Speech TV provides and Democracy Now! And Pacifica Radio that there's some sanity, some hope for sanity to take hold in this country, because you're not going to find this type of content on Fox, I can guarantee that.
Or even on the corporate.
Anyway, you still with me?
I am, yeah.
Okay. I have an experience that parallels yours. This goes back to the mid or late 1980s in Houston, and I was in my mid or late 20s at that time, so I was cemented as an adult. Mm-hmm. And I had an experience that really threw me for a loop. It really called into question who exactly we are, who we think we are, and how much control we really have over who we are. And, you know, like one psychologist one time said that our psyche is like unfolding an onion. You peel back all the onions until you get to the very core, and it's just basically our memories and our opinions. So here's what happened. This one day in the lobby of the community radio station where I was volunteering, one of my co-volunteers, who was a gay man, several years older than me, he was meeting some of his friends, male friends, and they hugged and they kissed in the lobby, and I just happened to see that I was sitting by the magazine rack, and I had this strange physical, visceral, negative reaction to it. And it occurred to me a few minutes after that I had that reaction. I said to myself, why am I feeling this way? You know, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that speaks to your idea that we have a lot of these tapes that are set into us when we're very young, and they keep playing throughout our lives.
Right.
And until we have an experience that calls into question, we don't really know to erase those portions.
Right.
I was really ashamed of myself, so don't feel too bad about it. I think it's a normal part of discovery and then a reclamation of our of who we are.
I think so, too. And at first, I mean, last night when I got the aha, and Louise and I kind of talked this thing through, and we're kind of game theorying it, you know, I mean, how would I have, what would I have thought if he had been a black man wearing a suit as opposed to he was wearing just, you know, a jacket and jeans? I mean, like a kind of not, I don't think it was leather, but you know, the, not a sports coat. What if he had been in a business attire? Would I have thought differently? A or B, if he had been a white guy who was dressed, you know, like he didn't have a lot of money. Or if he was a white guy in a suit. I mean, you know, was it a class distinction? Was it a race distinction? Was it both? What, you know, what triggers what tapes in our brains, you know? Because Louise, yes, lacking any information.
The other aspect of it, too. And I'm not denying, and I'm not trying to minimize the idea that we have racist problems. We certainly do.
Yeah.
But I think the underlying thing is this classist, this war on classes to separate people by class.
Yeah.
And racism is a very convenient, powerful tool to accomplish that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Johnny, very well said. Thanks. Thanks a lot for the call. We will be right back, 20 minutes past the hour. You know, every Thursday I get Louise and Sean, who really run this show, our executive producers, give me 3 minutes to talk about science. Okay, let's get geeky on glucose. Parents always tell their children that sugar makes your teeth rot out and fall out, you know, but according to new research, sweets may eat away at your intelligence, too. Researchers at the Charité University of Medicine in Berlin, Germany, studied 140 healthy adults ranging from 50 to 80 years old with no history of diabetes or being pre-diabetic. They took brain scans of each of the study participants and did other tests to determine the relationships between blood sugar levels and brain activity. The brain scans showed that the study participants with higher blood sugar levels also had smaller volumes in their hippocampus, the area of the brain that's responsible for memory. So, you know, experts who think that lowering blood sugar levels to normal ranges can help with cognitive and memory issues and potentially prevent future issues with memory might be right. So if you want to keep your teeth white and your brain working to the best of its ability, it might be time to cut back on those sugary sweets. So, anyhow, back to the issue of class and race and all this kind of stuff in the United States. What do we do about this? I think that reparations are in order, and not just, by the way, for African Americans, but also for Native Americans. And secondly, how do you do that? I think that affirmative action is probably the cleanest way to do that, along with reengaging Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, which has been, by and large, completely taken apart over the years. But your thoughts on this, Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard.
Well, I guess I can attribute my lack of intelligence to being so sweet.
Oh, yeah.
That's another story.
Sugar junkie. Okay.
Yeah. To relate to Callista Gingrich's choice of an image in order to attract children.
The elephant, yeah.
If I said Sammy Davis Jr., Muhammad Ali, Jackie Robinson, Bill Cosby, Louis Armstrong, Chuck Berry, these were the few blacks that we had to relate to and that black kids had to relate to in our time. If we were to do that list today, it would take hours, the prominent blacks.
Yes.
I think because of that, a lot of us grew up with that latent prejudice, and I think that is going to make a change today because of the fact that there are more blacks to relate to.
I think you're right, and I think that that's why my children's generation and if I had grandchildren, that generation are less I think there's less racism there and unconscious racism. I mean, there's less conscious racism as well because...
No, I think...
Go ahead.
I think the Republicans are relating to this now, too. I've gotten some inside information on the next candidate's qualifications that they have set up. It's going to be a black lesbian woman.
Right. Well, I don't think it was a coincidence that when I started defending Alan Grayson, that the largest Tea Party group contacted us and said, we have a spokesperson for you. We put her on the air yesterday, and she was an African-American woman defending the Tea Party and saying that they were not racist. And, you know, I've seen a lot of Tea Party rallies, and I've never seen a person of color at one. But when,
yeah,
you know, but they, but they're, and I don't want to diminish her in any way. You know, hey, a gig is a gig, and maybe she's a true believer too. And if so, God bless her. I mean, you know, I think she's misinformed,
well,
but I don't think that was a mistake.
Yeah, I roll up my window and lock my door when I see a Republican.
Yeah, there you go. Howard, well said. Thanks. Thank you very much. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. Now, I think this, you've started a conversation which I think should be continued and expanded, because this is what one of the real issues of our society. And talk about racism. I remember the owner of the Red Sox, Tom Yawkey. He wouldn't recruit a black player. And in 50, 60 years when he owned the Red Sox, I remember playing high school football. I grew up in a town with 1,500 non-whites, 90,000 people in the town, 1,500 non-whites. And this is 1960 census. And I remember a high school coach saying, we can't have blacks playing quarterback because they have weak ankles. Now, that's racist. That is real rabid racist.
Yeah, that's the old Howard Cosell stuff.
Yeah, I grew up in the other guy there, the black buck, you know, the Snyder man, the guy who's talking about bets, you know, and I grew up listening to that stuff, and it was very impressionable.
Yeah.
And so I have the same acculturated racism.
So you've got that tape running in your head, whether you want it there or not.
Yeah, when I see a black person, I see a black person. I don't see a person, you know. Even though here's an example. My wife is Cape Verdean. Her father said that she could marry first a Cape Verdean, then a white, and then a black person. Now that's how.
What's the ethnicity of Cape Verdeans? I'm unfamiliar.
They're from an island off the Cape Verde Islands off the coast of Senegal, Africa. They're a mixture of Portuguese, African, and Arab.
So your wife is a person of color?
Yeah, she's a person of color. So they came here in the early 1900s,
right,
primarily by ship. They were fishermen in Portuguese.
Right.
And they settled in the Cape Cod area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and now they're settling in Boston areas. They're coming to Boston.
Yeah, so that's remarkable that even her father was looking at, you know, at this racial caste system in terms of who she could marry, who he would allow his daughter to marry. Frank, we're out of time. Thanks for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. We will be right back. It is 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
By the way, remember back in 2003 when the Republicans rolled out Medicare Part D and people couldn't enroll and there were all kinds of problems? John Boehner went on TV and said, we need to fix this. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. We've been talking today, really in a way, kind of picking up on a conversation that we started, was it yesterday or the day before, where Alan Grayson had called out the Tea Party for a faction within it that has eerie resemblances to the KKK and uses a lot of old Klan imagery, including the Confederate flag, And then we had somebody from the Tea Party on rebutting that, an African-American woman, in fact. But I still think that Grayson is right. And then this experience that I had in the subway yesterday, and what it taught me about, you know, the tapes that play in the back of my head that I guess I've been aware of all these. I remember taking that Harvard study back some years ago where they show, it's online, where they show you pictures and you figure out what your unconscious biases are. It's wired into all of us. I know that. But I just, you know, I really came face to face with it myself yesterday. Sherman in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Sherman, what's up?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom?
Great.
Hey, two quick things. One, I'm from Chicago. I work for the utility company here. I don't want to say their name. And I'm a meter reader, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess you can tell by my voice that I'm a black guy. I read the meters in some of the most affluent neighborhoods in the Chicagoland area. I have on a utility company name on the hat, the vest, the sweater, the ID. I park the utility vehicle on the block so they know I'm with the company.
Right.
When I'm in, I guess I just have to call it like a white neighborhood, they'll call the police on me. And the police get there in like 2 minutes. But I say on the south side, if one of my friends gets shot or something, it takes them like 30 minutes to get there. You know, I just don't understand like how the world can be that way when in those same rich neighborhoods, they have like bull signs up or bear signs. If you ask them who their favorite player is, they're going to say Michael Jordan or Walter Payton. And so I don't understand why it doesn't translate over, you know, like there's a possibility that all black dudes aren't here to case your house. You know what I mean?
Because Sherman, a lot of it has to do with class and not race. Michael Jordan and who was the other person you mentioned? Oh, Walter Payton.
Walter Payton.
Those guys are rich. They may well be living in that same neighborhood or those kinds of neighborhoods. And so they're not perceived by rich white people the same way that even just middle class people are. I mean, you know, they're, and then, you know, on top of that, you layer race and you get a double dose of it. But the simple answer to why it takes a half hour for a response in a poor black neighborhood and 2 minutes for a response in an affluent white neighborhood is that we live tragically, and this is something that we all need to do something about, is we live in a society where there is privilege associated. You know, white privilege is real. And even though most white people are unaware of even what that phrase is or what it means, it's real. And it's something that we need to take on. And we made a really serious effort to take this on in the 60s. The Lyndon Johnson administration, between the Great Society programs and all the civil rights stuff that got done, a really serious effort to take this on. And then Reagan became president, and we've been taking it apart. We've been undoing that ever since. In addition to undoing the racial stuff, we're undoing the class stuff. Now the middle class is smaller than ever. The rich are richer. The poor are poorer. There's more and more distrust in our society as a consequence of that. So, Sherman, thank you for sharing your story. Go ahead.
Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah. I was going to say the other thing I was going to say is that it kind of also cuts both ways because I think you hit it right on the head with the class thing, because I'll find even with, you know, being a very nice neighborhood, even other African Americans will, be taken aback of seeing my presence over there. And like I said, I'll have my company logo on from head to toe. There's no way I'm over there for anything but official business.
Right.
And still, I'll get the same thing.
But you're not wearing a business suit.
There
you go. Yeah, I mean, there are classes associated with class, and one of those badges tragically is race, but the others are, you know, how we dress, how we do our hair, what kind of glasses we wear, oddly enough, and all these other things. Sherman, thank you for the call. Excellent, very insightful. Abdul in Gwin Oak, Maryland. Am I saying your name right?
Yes. How you doing, Tom?
Fine. Thank you for calling.
All right, thank you. Racism started with the beginning of mankind.
I don't doubt that.
It does. It did. And racism started with the Mayflower in the United States. They were racist against the Indians.
Sure.
Power is racism. The one who had the most power is the head of racism. The United States believe it is powerful, so he think it has the racism around the world.
That's right. I think that we never would have done to In the 1960s, when instead of going to war in Vietnam to stop communism, we had gone to war in Czechoslovakia, I don't think we ever would have covered the country with Agent Orange. I don't think that we would have destroyed villages in order to save them. I remember the slang, the slurs that were used against Vietnamese, against Asian people, to dehumanize them. And then, you know, again, we've got this war going on in the Middle East against people who are not, people of color, people in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's, I think that there's a very, very real element of racism in our foreign policy.
Yes, I'm a Vietnam vet, a Marine also,
mm-hmm.
and a combat Marine. I saw much racism in Vietnam.
I'm sure.
But racism don't have to go with different colors, the color of people.
Mm-hmm.
Racism can be among its own people.
Sure.
But Africans, in some ways, is racist against Black America. Because they feel like they didn't come on a ship of slavery. They came here on a plane. They feel like they're more educated. But I treat people how they treat me. If they treat me well, they get the best out of me. If they treat me bad, I keep distance from them.
Yeah, and I think that's the lesson for all of us. Abdul, thank you for sharing your story, and thanks for the call. Tracy in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Tracy, what's up?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
In regards to racism, you had asked the question earlier, how do we fix this?
Mm-hmm.
And just to kind of nutshell, like, 2 points here in regards to the past as well as the present. The present, I think there's a huge opportunity for us to do something big. What that is, I don't know. But kind of looking at the past and just really, to nutshell really quickly, my point before saying so, who I am as a person, basically born in a cardboard box, started out in a very poor neighborhood, predominantly Black. And I say Black, I take offense to African-American, even though I'm a white woman speaking, but it's part of their culture, part of my friends and people that I've grown up with that I happen to love very much. And I took it on in my life to be somebody to lift up rather than push down. And being in my 40s now, having 3 adult children, looking back on what I've done to make a difference, this issue isn't something that can be fixed overnight, even though we can have great strides at times throughout mm-hmm. life. Right now, I believe, is a time to take a great stride. But what I've done in the molasses years is make sure that my children don't take on that attitude as much as I can, putting them in citywide schools, not using racial slurs, not using anything that demeans another human being, just getting involved in important things like this, making sure my children are culturally competent, because ignorance is a huge part of it. And ignorance doesn't mean someone's bad. It just means they don't know. Mm. They haven't had that life experience.
Right.
So there's two. The answer to your question is twofold. There's things we can do that we feel don't make an effect, but make a profound effect in the long run. And then there are things we can do right now. The right now are the harder ones to answer, but the big picture sometimes can be easier.
Mm-hmm. And in the right now, we can do what, Tracy?
Right now, yeah, what can we do right now? Right now, I'm calling you, long-time listener and first-time caller, and right. I never thought I would be on the phone.
So what we could do right now is we can provoke the conversation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I want this not only on your show. I want to hear this everywhere. I mean, with all due respect, not everyone listens to you. They should, but they don't. And
I know.
We need this conversation everywhere, in the public eye as much as possible. It's huge.
Very well said. Tracy, thank you so much for the call, and thank you for your kind words. Joan in Elk Creek, Virginia, you're on the air. We have just a minute to the break, Joan.
Oh, thank you for having this conversation, Tom. I think it's really important. And I just wanted to say really quickly that the common thread I've been hearing in a lot of the calls is that a lot of times another race or another culture can be kind of scary when there's a group of people. But if you get to know a person one-on-one, no matter what their race or religion or culture, that's the only way you can get to know people. And this business about classifying a whole group of people like all Muslims or terrorists, I mean, that's just wrong. And unfortunately, I hear some of my conservative and Republican friends saying that, and it bothers me that that goes on. And having this kind of conversation, I think, is the way that we can bring it more to the forefront, and hopefully our children and grandchildren will continue that and be less racist than this generation.
Yeah, there you go. I'm totally with you, Joan, and that's why I decided to out myself here to share this story. Thank you for the call. And I this has been a fascinating conversation for me. We still have 15 minutes to go. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So it seems like a kind of a multi-step process. First, we do confront our own internal demons and racism, and then we confront it in our society and do something about it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Gail in Howell, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Gail, what's up?
Hey, it's kind of a funny story.
Mm-hmm.
It happened back in 1967, if that's okay.
Sure.
It was my freshman year at the University of Michigan, and it was the sorority rush. And I was a real Motown girl coming from that area of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to join the sorority rush. Not that I could afford it. My parents were pretty poor. They could barely afford to send me to college. And I made the big faux pas of dancing with the black guys because I knew all their dances, the Temptation Walk, the Miracle, and I danced with them all at every single rush I went to. And guess who didn't get asked to join the sorority?
Very interesting. Wow. Wow. That's...
But I had a great time.
Go ahead.
Lots of good parties, lots of good fun.
Yeah.
But I certainly didn't get asked to join any sorority.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Gail, thank you for sharing that story with us and for calling and for watching Free Speech TV. Michael in Fairfield, Pennsylvania. Hey, Michael.
Hey. Hi. How are you, Tom?
I'm fine. That was an amazing story from Gail, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. What my viewpoint on this is that I think it's all about class distinction, class problem. You know that this divide and conquer thing. You know,
I think race is a subset of class, and although it may be the other way around, I might be wrong. It'd be interesting to have a conversation with somebody who really knows this stuff.
You know, as long as they keep our focus away from what's really going on, you know what's the diminishing size of the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our society, you know, that as long as they keep throwing out racial incidences and differences in a different way, we'll lose focus on what is really happening. And I think that's what's going on. It's not, you know, if we can find something in common, like I could probably find something in common with somebody in the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
That if we, you know, that we want certain things that happen in the government. And that's the key, I think, is looking for the similarities, not the differences.
Yeah, yeah.
And why are your flags always at half-mast in the backdrop?
You know, that's an actual live photo of the U.S. Capitol. We're only three blocks away from it, and that's it's from a cam that's on the ceiling of a building right across the street from the Capitol. And I'm guessing that, and I have to move my head here. Yeah, it's at half-mast, which we project on the screen behind me. I'm guessing that somebody died. I know that there is that congressman. Everybody's flying down to Florida for his funeral.
But this is every day.
Bill Young. Yeah, I don't know why. It's probably, there's probably somebody dies almost every day. I just don't know. I've seen them flying not at half mast a lot. But that's an actual live picture. You're seeing the actual Capitol in real time. That's you're watching the sunset in Washington, D.C. as we come up on 10 minutes before 6 o'clock Eastern time. So that's what... No, Michael, I'm sorry I don't have the answer to that one. Thanks a lot for the call, though. We'll be right back. John Harbin here with you, and Keith in Elgin, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for your most informative progress.
You're welcome.
My story is about being a child in England at the end of the Second World War. And at school one day, about 1947, to the room, the classroom came this big, tall black man and this little black boy. You could have heard the jaws dropping. The 32 kids sort of, wow. And we saw, literally, our first black man. And what it was, he was a doctor. He'd been recruited because our country had been decimated during the Second World War, and we needed professional people. And he came to work in the hospital. His son was called Keith. Keith Walker. And I'm Keith Simpson. So after he'd gone and they left little Keith behind, this teacher said, what are we going to do? Sit next door to Keith Simpson, to Keith. So he sat alongside me, and the teacher then turned to the school children and said, now we have a problem. We have two kids. How are we going to distinguish them apart? I leave it to you children. So the children said, we will call Keith Walker Keith, and we will call Keith Simpson Sambo.
Whoa.
That is British, yeah, that is British cool boy humor.
Yeah.
And that name followed me all the way.
So you're the one who is called Sambo.
Yes. I'm white, Anglo-Saxon, male fella, Protestant.
Right.
And so it didn't faze anybody. No one worried, and I didn't worry.
Yeah.
And it followed me all the way through my civilian apprenticeship, then into my military career of 22 years with the British Army, and it only stopped when I joined an Arab Army. And I asked people who knew my name, don't call me that. I don't want to get into trouble over here.
Yeah.
So for 10 years, I was not called Sambo. But if you want to see racism and hear racism against their own people, the Arabs are terrible.
Huh.
I asked one of my men one day, where is Abdul Nasser? He hasn't turned two today. And they said, oh, he's gone on leave. I said, well, I didn't know. How come I didn't know? They said, he's gone to buy a wife. I said, well, where the heck's he gone to buy a wife? They said, oh, in Africa, he's going to buy a Sambo wife. And they would call. The light-skinned Arabs would call dark-skinned Arabs Sambo negatively.
Well, I know that, you know, Alan Ratner took a couple of us, my son and I, Justin and I, to northern part of South Sudan, right on the border with Darfur and with Sudan to the north. And South Sudan is black African, and Sudan is light-skinned Arab. And Darfur is black African. And the Arabs in the lighter skinned Arabs in Sudan have for centuries made a practice of raiding the Dinka villages in South Sudan and taking people as slaves. And Ellen is very, very involved in these efforts to free these slaves. And that's she started this charity, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can literally you know, help buy a goat to help save a rescued slave, to give them all of their life back. So, yeah, I've seen that myself, Keith, with my own eyes. I mean, it's, in fact, there's a picture of me and a couple pictures of me in Sudan on, over at TomHartman.com. Amazing. Thank you for sharing your story with us. It's great to hear from you. Sam in Hampton, Virginia. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener and first-time caller.
Well, thank you.
Seriously interested in your own opinion and your own take on the difference between a supremacist and a racist. Thank you.
Sure. It seems to me that the words are probably interchangeable. I think there's a difference between racial awareness and racism. And racism, arguably, and this is something that, you know, I don't profess to be an expert about. But my my interpretation has always been that you are racially aware if you're noticing the differences. You're racist if you're making, like, hiring decisions based on those differences or you know, those kinds of things. So that would be what I would say. Vicki in Mondolvi, Wisconsin. Vicki, we have just 1 minute to the end of the show today. It's yours.
I wanted to shine a ray of hope on the young people. My granddaughter entered junior high school, and she was a very shy, withdrawn girl, and I worried about her making friends. She met a wonderful girl who she just felt was her soulmate, and they had a wonderful year in junior high school, and her friend had to move away, and she cried, and she felt sad, and we all suffered with her, and I did not even find out that she was Black until it was inadvertently mentioned in one of our conversations, and we're in the middle of Wisconsin. So there's hope for young people who are raised not to see color.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we, the generation who ended apartheid, raised our kids in a way that, and they're raising their kids in a way that racism is far less a reality, although it's still very much a reality, compared to the 50s and 60s, absolutely. Vicki, thank you for sharing that wonderful story with us. Coming up tomorrow, wrap up your week with us. First up, Brunch with Bernie, of course. Senator Sanders taking your calls. And from the House, I'll have a conversation with Congressman Alan Grayson about what's up next for the Progressive Caucus. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag your it. Get out there, occupy something, and get over to lasthours.org and share the good word. We'll be back.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at solarworld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. Angie'sList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at Angie'sList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.